Morton College campus on January 10th, 1979. Well, Miss Hendershot, it would be interesting to know a little bit about your early background. Perhaps you'd tell us where and when you were born as a starter, for instance.
Well, I got my start in a town on the Ohio River, and sometimes they referred to it as River Rats. Just all in fun, of course. When you live through a few floods, you move. And my first recollections of Bel Air, Ohio, where I was born, was that we had to go to a neighbor's house to get away from the water that was pouring in our front door when the Ohio River came up each springtime. And strange as it may seem, people still live right there on that riverbank and move every spring. But I think with flood control and all the scientific ventures of the government, they don't have as many floods as they used to have.
Why is it they stay?
I think there's a love of the land they can't leave.
And perhaps you'd give us your date of birth, if that's not too personal.
Oh, my heavens, no. I believe every person gets a year older every year. And I was born on April 30th, 1904. And I lived in Bel Air until I was in second grade. And my father was an enamel man, and when the enamel plant moved from Bel Air to Sebring, and we left the river completely, but every summer when I go down south, I get to the river as fast as I can and ride the river road down to Bel Air again.
Has a real pool.
A
perhaps
spot.
You'd tell us the name of your father, for genealogical
records.
My father
was Edward Albert Hendershot.
Would you happen to know the dates of his birth?
He was born in 1876.
And when did he die?
And he died in 1939.
Would you remember the name of your father's father?
No, I never knew anybody in my father's family excepting his mother. I knew a stepfather, and I'm not even, and his name wasn't my father's name, so I don't even know what his name was. But if my father were living today, he would be classed as a migrant. He walked around with his mother. She gave organ lessons in the country. And they would come to a house and stay there for their board and room. They'd give everybody in the family organ lessons. And when my father, I've heard him say when he was 6 or 7 years old, he went out and helped in the fields to get his food. And then when they would leave there after 2 or 3 days, they'd take a little piece of cornbread and a sack with them and walk to the next farmhouse.
Would you happen to know your father's mother's name?
Her name was Viola. Annie Viola.
The Viola is the last name?
No, or Hendershot.
Hendershot.
Annie Viola Hendershot.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about your mother's name?
Well, my mother was Annie Lee Moore.
Do you happen to know your mother's father's?
And her father was Lorenzo Moore. Her mother was Julia Ann. And they lived on a hillside in a lovely brick home. As is her parents, her my great grandparents, maybe her grandparents. And I've often wondered how they ever got a load of bricks up that hillside, let alone build a big house. And it stood there until about 3 years ago, and then they came along and took the bottom out from under it. District 9 coal.
Mm. This would be in the Bel Air area.
This was about 25 miles south of Bel Air. Their post office would probably have been a place called Aledonia. It's in the Belmont County.
Oh, I see.
Everybody down there lives in the county.
Right. Right. Now, what would have been your mother's maiden name?
Moore. Annie Lee Moore.
Oh, do you have any idea as to when your father's people came to the United States?
No, I think they came from Germany, and I've heard him say once or twice that they came about 3 generations back. And his people and my mother's people together came from either Germany or England. I did find out one day that the name Hendershot was von Hedershart.
Could you spell
Germany.
That?
It was V-O-N. H-E-Y D-E-R-S-C-H-A-R-D-T von Hedershart. And the reason I found it out, I read a story like an editorial in a paper one day, and a man discovered oil on his land down in Texas. His name was Hendershot, and after he became one of a wealthy oil man, he changed it to von Hedershart. So my father always said, as soon as we strike oil, we'll change our name.
Well, I think it's a good name just as it is.
My name is still Hendershot, so I've never struck a lot.
Do you have any idea as to where your people may have settled before they came to Ohio? Did they come direct from the old country?
No, the first I've ever been able to read about them, they settled on the bank of a little creek, and I always heard it called Captain.
How would you spell that?
Well, I didn't know how to spell it either. So one day I was browsing around the library and I came across a Belmont County history book. I thought, I'll take a look at this and see if I can find it. And the stream turned out to be called Captina, Captina, and was on the bank of that little stream that the Indians held their last stand in southern Belmont County. I discovered that day.
That's very interesting.
It was a deep stream of water because I've heard my grandfather say many times, I have a stereoptic and slide of it. They go down over the hillside in the afternoon late, get in a boat and go out where the water was so deep it was green, and whatever fish they caught, that was their supper.
Mm-hmm.
It was on Captain that all this happened. Those people in those days abbreviated everything. Nicknamed them. If your name was Anna, you were called Annie. No matter what, you got a nickname, so Captina turned out to be Captain to those people.
Mm-hmm.
And isn't it strange today on good farms today in Ohio, the government has given them a plot of land that can be made into a pond. And when we went out here south of the lines, not too many years ago, with the Ohio Agriculture Extension people, they told us the story of these lakes where a man can go out and catch his fish and go back and eat it that night. He doesn't have to go into town to buy it. And I thought, well, history does repeat itself.
Mm-hmm. Good point. Those dams, some people say, are much wiser than the larger dams mm-hmm. that they actually perform a greater service.
And there's schools and churches where there was a stream of water and a farm and a church and a school. Of course, you know, in those days, a family boarded and kept a school teacher in order mm-hmm. to have one.
Well, I'd be interested in some other recollections of your childhood period. You say you left Belair now when you were in the second grade.
In the second grade.
Maybe you could tell us something about your amusements as a child. How did people entertain themselves back then?
Well, we had a fence around our yard, and anybody who wanted to was welcome to come in our yard and play, but we weren't allowed to go out.
Why was that?
We were taught to stay at home where our mother looked after us. That was the main thing. We stayed in that yard, and we always had company. And it may not seem a strange thing in a way, but I have a picture of my mother's home. There were 26 people on the porch and in the yard on a Sunday evening. She said that was the average Sunday night gathering, and then they'd all walk up about a mile and a half up the hill to church. And I've often thought of that yard of ours. I've seen my mother bring cookies and a glass of cold water out for the people that were there, and maybe there'd be 15, 20 children playing in our yard. And some of their parents didn't know where they were. But my mother knew where we were. And one of the biggest entertainments that we ever had was when the organ grinder came along the street. He had a little monkey on a chain. And he cranked his organ, and the monkey brought us cups, and sometimes we would have a few pennies to put in the monkey grinders. If we put a nickel in, he'd stay and play for a long time. And the monkey would do all kinds of tricks on the fence. And on that same corner, I stood and saw my first automobile, too. It was an electric one.
Interesting. Now we're getting back.
Two old ladies came along in this car, probably more as old as I am now. And they were very careful going around the corner because Belair is very hilly. And they had an awful time getting around that street. And then I thought that was just wonderful. Last summer when I was down there, I had trouble getting around that street with my little Chevelle. It's still no wider than it was.
Did that electric car have trouble getting up the hills? And
well, you know, it was strange. They always knew how to go. Most of the time you went downhill. You could go up a short hill and take a horizontal ride, and then you could go down the hill again. Another chosen bit of recreation we had, boats were free. And every Sunday afternoon, late in the afternoon, my dad would take us down the street. After we moved from the flood area, we were about two blocks from the river, and we'd get a boat. They were there by the dozens. Loosen the chain, we'd get in that boat and row up the river or across the river. And if we were very flushed that week, we might get a bag of popcorn someplace. But that was a lot of fun to ride.
Now you say the boats were free. Well, who provided the boats, I wonder?
The city, I suppose. I never thought about who. Because everything was volunteer. Now, the fire department was a volunteer fire department. I still see my father pulling on his coat and running down the street when they would ring a bell, and four or five men get in front of that cart and hose, and down the street they go to where the fire was. They must have had to have a lot of those stations. I know they had them in every ward, and perhaps more than one in a ward. Because they would, and then after that, they came the horses. They had the big spotted horses, you know, that pull the fire engines.
Well, I'd be interested in some details about your early schooling, about the, perhaps differences between the sort of education that you received and the education available today.
Well, I can remember in my first grade that every morning when you went to school, we must have had to study some at home, because the earlier you could read your reading lesson, the better grade you got in first grade even. So it meant we had to do a little bit at home, didn't it? Then we moved, we came up to Alliance, and I finished my second year of schooling here at South Lincoln School. And there was such a difference between the school there and the one here, because there was a different group of people. People here were employed, and they had a lot more to live on than we ever had. And one of the things I noticed down there in our schooling, everybody helped everybody else all the time. And up here, people just looked at you and said hi and went straight on. It took me a long time to get used to that, but the people in the river area were just much more friendly, I think, all the way around them. They were in the city. I think it's still that way.
Would it be the result of the people down there every so often being up against the problems of the flood?
I think so, because there were times when you had to fight to survive. I know that the year that we moved from the floodland, that my father kept a boat tied to the front porch, banister. And he and another man would row up this river to the upper part of the city and get bread and come back down the street and toss it onto the porches or windows, into the windows to people who were waiting for something to eat. And you never stopped to ask who anybody was. Well, then when the flood went down, everybody helped everybody else. They went along with shovels and shoveled out the mud, and then this volunteer fire department came along and washed the mud off your rugs and any furniture that was full of creepy crawly things you put out in the backyard, soaked them with gasoline, and struck a match to them and told them goodbye. And then it was nothing to have somebody else say, well, I've got two of this, I'll let you use mine till you can get another one. But you just don't do that today as much as, but I think we brought it on ourselves because too many people take advantage until you don't know whom to help and whom to befriend and whom to ignore.
You mentioned that you went to South Lincoln. Would the physical plant have been what it is about?
No, it was just that middle section.
Just the middle section.
But you can tell the difference in the color of the brick.
Mm-hmm. Well, who was the principal back there?
Well, that I don't remember. I just went there a few months because we came to Sebring. That's where they built the new enamel plant where my father was to work. And he drove back and forth on the streetcar each day. And as soon as he found a house, we moved to Sebring. Very early spring, and
you mentioned the enamel works. What sort of things did they make?
Well, they made kitchenware, and what was known today as an indirect light. It was a light that had a big enamel shade, and inside was a cone in which you screw the light bulb. But mostly kitchenware was what they made, pots and pans, and my father, the man who owned the plant in Bel Air, taught my father to make the enamel.
And now, who ran this plant in Sebring?
A man by the name of Thomas Strong.
Strong enamel.
Strong enamel. And Dad, I think Dad didn't even have a stepfather after he was just a youngster, because he'd gone to school about, I suppose, all together maybe 3.5, 4 years. My mother didn't even have that much schooling. It was too muddy in the spring to go. It was too cold in the winter. And the fall, they had to help with the crops. So they'd average, I've heard her say, they averaged about 3 to 4 months of school a year. And she got about to third grade. But how they really picked up everything that went along, and they really enjoyed radio and television when it came into existence. And Mr. Strong was a well-educated man. I don't know where he had gotten his education, but he was really wonderful to my dad. And when I went away to college, they would send me money and give me things too, because they had only one grown daughter, and they were just wonderful people. And he was the kind of man that stood at the door on payday and gave every man his pay in cash and wished him a happy weekend, you know.
Well, is that plant still in existence?
Well, it's still down there, but it's used for something else. After Mr. Strong left Sebring, it went into the hands of someone who made an aluminum plant out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But he had a pretty hard job in Sebring, because Sebring had been founded by five Sebring brothers and their father. And they just worried about letting anybody else in the industrial world. And Mr. Strong just didn't sit with them. He was an elder in the church, and he taught a class. Some of them didn't even know there was a church in existence. They just lived different kinds of lives completely. And actually stayed there for quite a long while. And then he liked a little place, so he sold his plant and went down to West Lafayette and bought a small plant that made hospital ware.
Hmm.
And my father, then they made it like you do cooking today. They made it from scratch.
Mm-hmm.
And that was the year he decided he was going back to the farm when Mr. Strong sold out. The man who came in there in his place didn't fire anybody, but they cut everybody's wages.
That would take care of it.
And you couldn't live on the wages because he was a money-making man. Mr. Strong was a humanitarian.
Mm-hmm. Now, about when did Strong leave?
Well, Strong left there in about 1925, I think. And then we went on the farm 1 year, and it was too much for us and not enough to hire, so we went back to town. And then my father took a job as superintendent in the milling department in a nailing plant, Canton Stamping, over in Canton, Ohio. And there, it was like today, the pressures were just terrific. And Mr. Strong's son-in-law, who knew my dad's abilities, called him one night on the phone and said, "Ed, if you come down to West Lafayette and straighten out our problems, I'll give you a year's salary no matter how long it takes you." And it took him about 3 months. And Frank gave him his year's salary, and he says, "Now I want you to be doing this kind of thing. I don't want you back in one of these shops where they're on top of you all the time." And he'd been home about 2 weeks, and he got the same kind of an invitation from Charleston, West Virginia. And it took him about 6-7 months down there to get their problem straightened out. And they gave him a year's pay. And then a friend said to him, "Why don't you go up to Cleveland and apply for a position with the Faro Corporation?" "Oh, Dad," says, "I've never lived in a big city. I couldn't do that." He says, "You wouldn't have to live there. You could work there and stay home." Well, he went up there on a Monday morning for an interview, and at 4 o'clock that afternoon, they gave him an expense account and started him on the road. And he worked from then until he died.
Mm-hmm.
And all he did, he had a territory from Pittsburgh, south to Charleston, and west to the Mississippi. Wherever there was a problem, well, he would be sent. I don't really know anything about enamel or not, but the biggest problem of it is when the enamel is ready to burn, if it's not like it ought to be, when it's burned, it just looks like you've sifted pepper on it.
Hmm.
They call it fish scales, I don't know why. And it was his job to go and find out what was causing the fish scales. And it was interesting, but if he'd had some more chemistry, he could have done it more easily, I think. And through his efforts, because he had to work at night when people were gone, I worked in there too. And I think the only thing I never did in an enamel plant was fire furnace.
Well, I can see your father was a great problem solver. I can understand so well now why you're able to cut through so many difficult problems.
Well,
Miss Henderson,
can't cut through
that,
like he did, but
makes it all
all this
clear.
Work in the shop has just paid off a thousandfold, because when I went finally back to school later on in my life and had to do student teaching after I'd already taught 2 years in grade school, the head of the sociology department, I had to teach under him, and I had made a D in sociology at Denison because I didn't have the library time, I had to work.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Do you want me to come in or stay out?" I said, "I want you in there because I don't know the answers." But that was the only class I could get. And the first 2 days were introductory days, you know. and was on industrial relations with women in the shop. And after the third day, I got a call to the office, and I thought, well, this is goodbye. And he wanted to know if I'd make him a bibliography where I got my materials. He couldn't believe anybody. He had never worked. He'd never done anything but be in school. He just couldn't believe.
Anybody knew anything else?
Anybody, there was anything else to learn.
Now, where was this?
This happened when I did my senior year at Hiram College.
You were teaching in a nearby school there.
And, well, I had done 2 years of teaching because I didn't have the money to go my 2 years after my junior year. And then my senior year, I went back, but I still had to take student teaching because I hadn't had it. It was a requirement.
Now, let's see, we've talked about your elementary schooling, this little experience at least that you had at South Lincoln. Then where did you get the rest of your...
In Sebring. We lived in Sebring until I was a junior in college.
I see. Then you went to which high school?
Well, I went to Sebring High School. And my grade school is the Lincoln Apartments now down in Sebring. I don't know how they made them into apartments, but we had all our high school, and I had 3 years in the second floor of that building.
Well, then, to what you did mention Hiram. Was all your work at Hiram?
No. As I said, when I was in high school, I hardly knew what a college was, because my parents hadn't gone, you know, or anything. And one of my teachers decided that I should be a teacher. And she just never stopped until I was registered at Denison University. And the reason I went there, I got the best scholarship of the places that she had suggested. And I would like to have gone to Hiram. It was our church school, and my dad would have liked it too, but it would have cost me a lot more a year, so I went to Denison instead. Then at the end of my junior year was when the Depression really hit, and there wasn't a penny outside of grocery and clothing, you know, and that was the year we hit the farm. So I took a teacher's examination and got a certificate to teach just to see what it was like. I didn't know I was going to teach. And then I taught 2 years in grade school, and got $900 a year.
Where was this?
I taught over Mahoning County. It was funny, down in Denison one Saturday morning, we had a breakfast. And I said, where's everybody going? Well, they're going over to New York to take teacher's exams, scared to death. And they were seniors. And I said, well, I think I'll just go along and see what they're like. I'll take them next year. Well, you know, there's a little tiny bit of fine print, and it said, there are 15 examinations in this envelope. If you take all 15 and fail one, you will return next month and repeat the examinations. If you omit one examination and fail any, you come back next month and take the one you omitted and the one you failed. Well, I sat there and looked at that. I thought it was a gimmick for a minute. So, thinking well of myself, I took everything but spelling. And by the middle of the week, I got a card, congratulatory card from the State Department on successful completion of those 14 examinations. Never heard a word from these seniors. And it came the next month, they said, well, are you going back too? And I said, oh, yes. They said, well, join the rest of us. None of us got through either. And they all had taken all 15. And they had studied for 3 months for those exams. They were everything that you would teach from kindergarten through eighth grade. And I really pulled myself together for four kinds of horses and two kinds of cows and agriculture, you know, and that kind of thing. But at any rate, I went back and I was all set to spell 100 words when I was handed a sixth grader's test paper and given 10 minutes to grade it and make all the corrections necessary on a 100-word spelling test. So I passed that. Next week I got a letter, congratulations, and my certificate to teach in the elementary schools in Ohio. Then when I went home in May or June and found out I couldn't go back the next year, I started looking for a school where you'll have to take the examinations. And this was in Mahoning County near our farm, and I said, well, I already had. But they said, well, get us your copy of your grades. So I got my copy of my grades. I said, well, get us 50 cents and have a Mahoning County certificate. My other one was in Licking County. So I taught 2 years in Mahoning County then, and then Dad had taken this job in Canton, and we were over there, and Mr. Welshner told me one day, he says, you know, you ought to go back and get that year of school. He was a minister there. So he got me two jobs over at Hiram College. I hated to change schools, but I loved every minute at Hiram. I had friends from there I'd hate to think I lived without the rest of my life.
Now, do I understand you had 2 years at each school?
No, I had 3 years
three
at Denison.
One at Hiram. Mm-hmm.
And isn't it a coincidence, they got a new president at Hiram. Came the year after I left, but he came in springtime and stayed with us. And he said he would never stay on a campus more than 10 years. He says, by that time, even the freshmen know what you're going to say before you say it when you're the president. So at the end of 10 years, he resigned and took up the position of Denison.
Interesting.
So when I'm back to homecoming, I go to both places most every
That's
year.
That's amazing. Amazing.
And to hear that he would hit the same schools, you know.
Right. Did you notice much difference in tone of life between Denison and Hiram?
The only thing that was different was that there was a little more closeness.
Closeness.
Of people, friendship-wise. And yet there wasn't too much either, because I've always liked people, and you make friends if you want to a lot of the time. And I have a lot of friends at Denison. Last year, 2 years ago, I guess it was 27, would have been my graduating year there. And they gave us a whole weekend as guests of the university. We went in there Friday night. We had a dormitory to ourselves. We had our 50th reunion there, and we just had a good time. And this next year, spring now, will be my 50 years out of Hiram. So they're already planning what they're going to do. But they're friends at both places, and I like both schools very much. It'd be a toss-up today. I don't know which one I would choose.
Well, then after you graduated from Hiram, what happened?
Well, that was a year there were no positions. And there were 55 of us graduated over there, and 5 of us got schools. I had just been everywhere looking for schools. And on Wednesday evening, before school started, a friend of mine and her parents from Donna Boyd were up here at Mount Union at a flower show. And they were friends of the Vaughns and the Stantons. And they asked Mary Vaughn in the course of the evening what she was going to teach the next year. You knew Mary, I think. Well, she says it's a toss-up. She says, I'd like to teach science. But I'm teaching Latin, and as of today, she says, there is neither a science or a language major on the spindle on Dad's desk. And he says, whichever one comes along, I have to take the other. And my friend said, well, I have a good friend who is a language major and is hunting a job. And she had been my high school English teacher. She wasn't much older than I. She did grade school in 6 years and high school in 2.5. And went to Wellesley in a little over 2 years. She came back. She taught just because they asked her to. She didn't want to. And she told Mr. Stanton, and he says, well, if she's good enough to be your friend, I guess she's good enough to teach for us. So I went in on Friday for an appointment, and the secretary said to me, if you're here about a position, I wouldn't stay if I were you. She picked up the spindle, and she says, there are 51 applications on this, and we don't have a vacancy. And I said, well, I was told to stop here this morning, so I'd better wait for Mr. Stanton. He was coming in from Cleveland on the train. About that time, Mr. Vaughn came across the hall and asked me if I were by any chance Miss Hendershot, and I said yes. He said, well, come on, talk to me till Mr. Stanton comes in. So I went to the principal's office, and went in and sat down, talked a little while, gave me my schedule, my textbook, my grade book, took me down and showed me my room. And by the time Mr. Stanton had arrived, and why, I had a little paper bag with me, I don't know, but I put all these things in it. Went in, had an interview with Mr. Stanton, and you'd never guess what he said. I'll let you know in the morning at 10 o'clock if we can use you, but I think we can.
He had to check with Vaughn to be sure.
I found out that day who ran the public schools in Alliance, and it wasn't the superintendent either. So
that's
Monday morning I went to work in Alliance High School, but I'd have been afraid to apply for a job here because I'd never been in a big school. I didn't want to be in a big school, but I ended up there.
Mr. Vaughn was a pretty effective administrator, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. You know, he was so little, and yet everybody was petrified of him.
Mm-hmm. How do you do that?
Well, I don't know. I think it was his mannerism as much as anything else, because he walked down to me one day, the first week of school, and he said, "Miss Hendershot, I'm sure you have a general math book in his hand." And he said, "What do you know about this book?" I looked at him, I said, "It has a red cover." He said, "What could you do with the inside of it?" I said, "Absolutely nothing. Thank you for stopping by." And he went back to the office and told somebody, he said, "Well, Miss Hendershot's really a curt person, isn't she?" But he never asked me anymore to teach
something
general math.
Right.
And you just had to let him know that you thought too, and he respected you for it. He never held any grudges. Because I know one year I had 175 people in the balcony for a study hall in the auditorium. And he walked in there very calmly and said, "I'll have to make a little change in the study hall." I said, "You will?" He said, "Yes, I have 30 people I need to put in here 2 days a week." And I looked at him and I said, "175 and 30, that will make 205 people. And who will be my assistant?" "Well, there wouldn't be any assistant." And I said, "Well, Mr. Vaughn, where are these 30 people the other 3 days?" "Well, they were in one of the science classes, and that man would like to have those 2 days free." I said, "No, thank you. You tell the man I have no empty seats for sale. I'm sorry." And he just turned red as a peach, and he said, "I think I understand." And he walked away. He never came back again. And somebody told me I was going to get in trouble for saying that to him. So I think people were afraid of him to an extent, but I've never been afraid of people.
He appreciated if you do really stand up for your rights.
That's right. I think you have to do this. I think you need to be reasonable about it.
Miss Hendershot, I'd be interested in some more details on your tenure as president of the Alliance Education Association. What were some of the issues that were
citing people in? Well, the first big thing we worked on was equal pay.
Men and women?
For men and women. And I gave a talk over at Barberton one day, and the principal of high school said to me, "Do you think anything else besides equal pay?" And I said, "Yes, now, because we're getting equal pay in Alliance." The year I started teaching, I had 54 children in 3rd, 4th, and 5th grade. They fired my furnace on Monday. I had to keep it going. It was a big round thing in the back of the room. I had to do the playground for the first 5 grades at noontime. I coached the high school girls' basketball team because I had a minor in physical ed. And they told me, had I been a man, I could have had $950. But since I was only a woman, I got $900. And then at the end of the first year, I got a raise of $25. The men got a raise of $50. And almost the same kind of thing was going on here, because Mr. Stanton called me in and said he'd like to give me a raise. He didn't have the money, but he wanted to say thank you somewhere, so he gave me a raise of $25. The man down the hall went in and he got a raise of $75 from the same pocketbook. And there's some things you don't forget.
And so it was during your tenure that you were able to.
And so we started a salary index too. It was, we've been working on that. And that was one of the things the Board of Education would not go along with. They just, if I hear the teacher, she's a marvelous teacher, but she won't come in here for less than $1,700 or $1,800. We've got to have her. And then here they'll say, "You were there teaching, been there 10 years, and you were getting $1,500. So we got rid of that lower clause, and it wasn't easy either. But we had to keep after the people for memberships too. And I know that some of our people just couldn't. A man would say, "Well, I belong to the National Association, my wife belongs to the state. We only need one magazine." And we would say something to them like this, "Well, suppose you become ill, how many insurances do you expect to collect?" Well, that sort of something to think about too. And then at that time we had in Ohio what we call leadership training courses for officers of the association. And we met in August for a week. We had about 250 teachers come in Sunday and finished up at noon Wednesday. Then we just reversed the programs, and we had the same speakers Tuesday and Wednesday and Thursday. We'd have them go home, and another 250 come in and stay till Saturday. And we worked on the responsibilities of a president and a secretary and a treasurer and a salary committee. And it got to such a pitch with the Board of Education and the people in power, that the thing that we wanted and the thing that they wanted. I remember one night, Lisa Pettis and I were over in Canton putting mail in the post office for the superintendent, for the editor of the repository, and then came back and put our letters in the Board of Education men's mailboxes so that everybody was equal. And they soon found out that whatever we did, we treated everybody the same. And that was one of the things we tried hard to do. When they wanted me to make a decision, I said, no, I have an executive committee. And that executive committee would come to a meeting at 10 o'clock at night if I called them. And we'd formulate a statement, take it to the Board of Education. They soon found out that we were together and we were not being unreasonable about things. And it helped a whole lot, I think.
And in general, wouldn't it be true that during your tenure, the teachers gained a greater share of participation in the decision-making process?
We would have the year before I was president, they had a teacher's spring banquet. And I think they said they had 45 people there. Well, that time we must have had almost around 200, more than 200 teachers. So I appointed a committee of 50 people. Every building included. And I know one teacher said to another one evening, what are you going to wear to the banquet? She says, I'm not going. And she says, your name's on the list. You're one of the hostesses. And they never told me they wouldn't be there. They were there. But I had a person from every building in the receiving line. So they couldn't come in and say, there's nobody here I know. But we had, to me in life, graciousness and gratitude are just too important acts. And we had never practiced either one, either faculty or students, or teachers. We were just taken for granted. And I know when Dr. Hammond came, I had never done anything with a new superintendent. I didn't know what to do. But I happened to be in a meeting in this leadership thing where the NEA president was present. And I had seen her perform in the United Nations. I knew she knew what to do. And I called her and I said, well, 10 minutes of your time. And I told her we had to do something for a new superintendent. She says, get your paper and pencil out. She said, write down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 what to do. Told us how to invite people, whom to invite. For instance, we had the board members and the new superintendent to dinner. Then my representative assembly went out to their homes and got their wives, because we didn't have the money to have them all. And they joined them in the receiving line here with the women's club. And everybody thought it was a beautiful party. Well, about six of us worked hours and hours and hours getting that ready. But everybody had a good time. And from then on, we didn't have very much trouble getting people to join in what we were doing.
And was it during your tenure that you worked out a system to welcome the new teachers?
That's right. The year I came here to teach, every day, we had a cafeteria in the YWCA then. Every day at noon, I walked down Arch Street to eat in that cafeteria by myself. I went in, there were about a dozen teachers sitting over at another table, and I sat over here alone, and never once did they ever ask me to eat with them. I didn't have time to get a room here, unfortunately. We lived only in Canton, so I went home. I did my traveling by streetcar till I found a place to live. And I would see them. I recognized them in the high school. But one day, there were two people there of caliber, Mabel Hartzell and Grace Schaefer. Mabel was history department head, and Grace Schaefer was music supervisor. And Mabel came over and she said, young lady, I think I see you in our halls, don't I? I said, yes, you do. I see you. And she said, well, come and eat lunch with us today. And I did. And Grace lived in a home here in town where there was one empty room. They wanted a third roomer. And she took me out after school, and I took that room, and we had our breakfast there and our dinner there. And we talked about this thing. Is it, well, nobody ever had done it. So again, we had an association here then called Association for Childhood Education. It was an elementary teachers' national organization. And I asked them to help, because at that time you were getting more elementary changeover than secondary. And we had a breakfast for those people. And I sat down and wrote a letter to each one. I got their name from the superintendent's office and wrote each one a letter. And not very long ago, one of the a teacher here said she remembered how I met her at the train the first day she came to town. Well, then the next year, we parceled that out to the executive committee and representative assembly. And I'd write them the first letter, and then I would give them this person's name, and I'd give a copy of the letter to that person, and pretty soon I didn't have to write any letters. And then insurance companies took over the financing of that breakfast. We gave each one a red carnation when they came to town at our first meal. And I think maybe now even the, it's not the insurance, maybe the citizens or someone in town sponsors that breakfast or luncheon, whatever it is. And here a teacher would land in line, she didn't know where a building was, and we'd take them out. And we didn't have a car, sometimes I'd even have to go by taxi, but most of the time I could get a teacher with a car to do it. We'd go visit the building, and incidentally, when I took them, I got to see the building too. And it was a pleasant thing to do. People had a good time doing it, and they felt a responsibility to help that new teacher. And you have to be awake when you're dealing with people because they're easily hurt.
Very, very true. Well, let's see, during your tenure, did you have any participation in the selection of a new superintendent? Were you involved in personnel decisions on the administrative level?
Well, I don't know who made that suggestion, but someone made the suggestion that teachers be consulted when superintendents were hired, because they might know the people too. So it was decided at the Board of Education meeting. I never missed a board meeting. I sat in the back of the room and crocheted pot holders. One day the president says, "I wonder what Madame Defarge is doing back there tonight." So anyhow, they voted to have this committee of teachers working with the Board of Education, and I can see why they feared it. They were afraid they would come up with a name and we would say no, and there, that wouldn't be for good. So they were very fair about it. All these dossiers, they call them, I forget what they call them then, but they were half pages of single type things. Some of those things were an inch thick. Came up here from Ohio State, insured mail. They went to the clerk of the Board of Education read them, and then they were brought to me. And incidentally, the president demanded that I be chairman of the teachers section of that committee. So I chose Clyde Stanley and Lena Trotline as the two people to work with me on that. And we read all those things, all those biographies separately, and then we discussed them. And one night we were called to a meeting at 5 o'clock, and the Board of Education and the teachers group selected the same five people in the same order, not at all for the same reasons.
Amazing. Now that was when what superintendent was chosen?
Dr. Hammond.
That was when Dr. Hammond came.
And when they decided to let Mr. Schaefer go, he decided not to go. And for 48 hours, I'll never forget, we had two superintendents on our payroll. He didn't have to leave until the 31st of July, and he didn't. And Dr. Hammond and I set up the program for the Alliance Education Association by telephone and by luncheon meetings in Salem, so we were ready to go the first day of August.
But in the meantime, Mr. Schaefer had stayed on in the office.
He stayed on until the 31st of July, because that's when he had to leave. That was when his contract expired, and he wasn't going to leave until then.
Now, what were some of the reasons why he had to go, I wonder?
Well, I think Mr. Schaefer was a fine person, a good person, but I think he was just not big enough for the job here. At any time, I can look back and see now, any time he ever hired anyone, he was very careful to hire someone who couldn't surpass him in performance. And there came a time when his performance wasn't great enough for the problems that were arriving here.
Whatever happened to him?
Well, last I knew of him, he was selling books. I think he's still living. I know the reason why I shouldn't know, because he had Warren Davis here as principal in the high school. And Warren Davis is one of the best administrators this town ever saw. And I think there came a day when Mr. Davis was ready to use his own wings. And the sad part of it was that Russell Schaefer's aunt, by Mary, became my mother's sister-in-law.
Amazing. I compliment you for keeping that straight.
And they would say to my mother and my sister, "What's Helen say about Russell?" Mom says, "Well, she says anything about him." They said, "Well, we hear he's having trouble in school up there." Mom says, "Well, he may be, I don't know." And one woman said to my mother in town, "I didn't know you and Helen and your other daughter didn't get along very well together." And Mama says, "I don't know what you're talking about." Well, she says, "You're standing here saying you don't know a thing about the school situation in Alliance when it's so bad right now." And it always is. It's worse, sounds worse than it is sometimes, because a little bit of trouble looms brightly in people's eyes. And Mama says, "You know, when Helen comes home, she leaves school at school." And she says, "We just never discuss it." That way they didn't have to fib. They didn't think about it. Well, he always spoke to me. We never. The only time he ever asked me to do anything for him was when a PTA tried one night. They're taking the running back in their building because they felt he was too dictatorial and they couldn't go to him with the problem and get any satisfaction. That was the reason. And the next morning he was standing by my door when I went to school over at Stanton. And he said, "You were the same place I was last night." And he said, "I knew this was going to come someday." He says, "I wonder if there's anything the association can do on my behalf. I feel that this is the week to do it." And I said, "Well, Mr. Schaefer," I said, "I know you're having problems. But," I said, "we have problems too." And I said, "the same board that hired you hires us." I said, "You recommend us to them. I don't know who recommends you to them, but," I said, "we work for the self-same Board of Education, and I don't feel I should dabble in with their affairs." And I just said no more about it. And he says, "I understand." And he went on his way. But there's something you have to learn to solve some way without getting into them. I don't know. Sometimes you can't either. You get into a lot of trouble.
Do you still have confidence in the education associations? I was reading the other day in the one of the magazines that the NEA has become just another pressure group.
Yeah, people say to me, "Boy, I tell you, I'm going to get out of the NEA." And I said, "You are?" "Yeah, I'm about through with this and through with that." And I said, "Well, where are you going to go with your grievances?" Well, they didn't know. And I said, and just like when we were having difficulties here and we didn't know what to do, I could get on the telephone and call the OEA and reverse the charges any time of the day that I wanted to, and I got help.
Was that in the days of Bliss?
Yeah, Walton Bliss was a state executive, and then I don't know whether he left, whether O'Keefe came in before I was out of office or not. I don't remember. Tom O'Keefe was then the executive too, but they were always, and Ed Hoon was another one, was always ready to help.
Who would be some other presidents of the Alliance Education Association whom you would single out for special effectiveness?
Well, I think every person in a position of leadership may have a lot of failure, but I think every person has some one thing, you know, that they can do too. And I think Joe Quinlan was a good president. I think Lucille Pettus did a good job as president. And of course, I think the best president we ever had was Bob Dowling. Bob would have been an NEA president had he not become afflicted with multiple sclerosis. And I found Bob, I took him to a leadership one day, a leadership conference. And on the way home, Bill Hunter was my vice president. And Bill said, "Well, who in the world's going to take over this association next year?" Because he says, "I wouldn't take it on a bet," because he says, "I don't have the time," and he says, he was a principal and he had a lot of work to do. And I said, "Well, he doesn't know, but he's asleep on the back seat." And Bob tells that every place he goes. And he was the president too the next year, and he sure did. They call him Mr. OEA. He's a fine educator.
He's still living.
Yes, I don't know how. He gets out without his walker, he falls, he has to ride to school now. But I said he'll be a better teacher in a wheelchair than most of us have been on our feet.
Oh, he's still teaching?
Oh, yes, he's over standing. He doesn't drive very much once in a while. But another teacher comes right by his house, and he rides up with her every day. His mother died last year, and he cooks, and but his brother and nephews and nieces just worship him, and they all help him a lot. But he has outfitted boys and girls, and I think he has 7 adopted children that he has supported a lot. And we've had a lot of good presidents here.
Well, I'd be interested in a little detail on your church work, Miss Hendershot. You've been extremely active.
Well, I said, had I known when I was a youngster what I know now, I'd have gone into church work full time, probably. But if I had, then I wouldn't be free now to do it either. And I said in school one day when we were writing papers on vocations, I said, you'll change your mind a dozen times now, but I said, put down what you think you'd like to be. Do a little dreaming. I said, for instance, and this was 2 years before I retired, I said, I don't know yet whether I want to be a nurse or a full-time worker in the church or a teacher. And I had a couple of adjusted classes, and this one little boy looked up a little bit, and he said, Miss Hendershot, don't you think it's about time you're making up your mind? And then we don't have an associate minister now, and there are just so many things to do all the time that he needs help with. When you've been in a church a long time, so I joined this church here in 1930. Came here to live. I was here the year before that. And I did the work in the children's division. Well, I did youth work until I had a sick spell and wasn't allowed out at night, and then I had to quit that. And so I went working with the children in the younger elementary, and I did probably almost 40 years in that. And now then, I was trying to find a way to get out one day, and the minister said, why did you ever think of phasing out of that division? I said, I've been trying for 2 weeks to write a letter of resignation to you, but I was afraid you'd think I was quitting because we have a new preacher. And he said, I didn't say anything about quitting. He says, we need a resource center. And he said, I think you could set it up. Well, it's been an awful drag, but we moved around and we tried to rearrange rooms, and it's still a mess, and I've been out a year and a half. But I just get up and get out to church every day, and if I want to do something else, I can. And otherwise, I can stay there. Now it's just like today, I can do things with the secretary. I don't type, so I do all the other things, and lots of times we fix lunch and eat down there, but there are so many things to do in a church that, and it's fun when you don't punch a time card, you don't get a paycheck.
I'm sure. Now, you've had some pretty important assignments within the church, I think. Haven't you been on the... Weren't you the first... do you call them elders in your church?
Yes, Clarence Steffi came to me one day, and he was chairman of the Board of Elders, and he said, I have the privilege, the personal privilege, of inviting you to be the first woman elder in Alliance First Christian Church. I said, well, that's humbling. And after we talked a while, he said, well, now I have one. He says, you've got a chance to make it or break it for the women. And I said, I'll buy that, Clarence, if you'll tell me who's been making it and breaking it for the men. Clarence turned around and he says to the other man, he says, I told you what she'd be like. We must have 4 or 5 men and elders now. And I have a committee assignment in our state on the Christian Education Commission. And I like that, too. It's interesting.
Now, what would be the year when you became the first woman elder in the Christian church here?
I don't know. How long has Clarence been gone?
It's like, 3-4 years? Not so long before that, or something.
No, I suppose maybe 5 or 6 years.
Something
Gladys
like that.
Knows it was a segment. And I said, I didn't say this to brag, but I said Gladys was selected as a woman of the year, you know, in Alliance. And she was the second person to become an elder. She's an elder emeritus now because she's in her 80s.
And what year did you receive the recognition as Woman of the Year?
Well, it had to have been 1970. Is that right?
Well, we can check that out.
Well, it wasn't 1970 either. 1970 is the year I retired. It must have been 1973.
I see. Well, I'm sure they had plenty of things to put on the recognition sheet, plenty of things to justify this.
That was a night and a half, I'll tell you.
Well, we've certainly
Dr. had. Freeman asked me if I wouldn't, he said, for some reason they got an extra ticket to the dinner. Wouldn't I go? And I said, oh, I always go, because the chamber was awful good to me when I was association president. I always have tried to go to their things, and not just because of that, but you got to work together. And finally I went with them, and then he let me drive. Any other time he always picked me up, but he let me drive that night. And I almost had the flu that night, and if it hadn't been for them, I probably would have stayed home, or tried it anyhow. And then when I went inside the door that night, Mary Laughlin, you know, used to work down at the bank of Stanley, and she laughed, spoke more than I said to Sam and Mabel. Well, she must have been looking for some big shot that she found. She looked so pleased, and they nearly doubled up. And then I went at the table and sat down opposite Harriet Miller. She was chairman of the committee that year. And I said, you're Harriet Miller. And she said, yes. And I thought, well, what did I say? Well, she had such a funny look on her face. And I said, well, I'm Helen Hendershot. And she said, yes, I know. Just and then after it was all over, she says, I have some mail for you in my purse. And she said, I just took her word right. She didn't know what to say or how she was going to introduce herself to me, but I took care of it. But I told them that now, I said, anything you get, to me, anything a person gets like that, most of the time, in my case, it was completely true. I owed it to my parents. It was not to me the honor was given, but it was to them.
I'm sure you made good use of the opportunities that they provided.
It was a real surprise. And
well,
things like that, to me, turn out to be a challenge. You know, if people say you do this and do that, then you got to get busy and see what you do.
Well, that was a fine culmination, I'm sure, but you've gone on and have continued to make a lot of contributions.
I think
in the years since.
All at once, when I went a couple of days after that happened, I thought, my land is that Coronation Festival parade, and I'm just not going to ride in that parade. But I did. And I said, I just never dreamed what the city looked like. They said there were over 20,000 people on those streets that night, and I know the lady from the chamber that rode with me said, we're going to have to speak to people tonight. I said, I think it's very rude if we don't recognize their recognition of us. And I said, why don't you take that side of the street, and I'll take this side of the street. The person should say, oh, somebody over here is calling you. She hadn't been here very long. And I said, the next day I really had a sore neck. Just from trying one side, but I never dreamed that there were as many people that I could think of by name as I went along that way last night. I said, it was really a treat to see the city. I said, they were the ones that were on parade. It was a real interesting experience.
Well, I'm sure it couldn't have come from a more deserving person than
you. I don't know about that, but it's...
Any of these comments that you've made have revealed your own...
And now we're having a really great experience in the church work. They divide our country into what they call areas. And each area contains so many regions, and our states are regions. And ours over here goes from the Maritime area up to Ontario down to Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And as far west as Ohio and a little bit of Indiana. And we call it an EDUCARE event. It's E-D-U and a hyphen and U and then hyphen and C-A-R-E, EDUCARE event. And there are three of them. The first one was held over in a place in New Jersey, in Pennsylvania, right near Hershey's. It's where they have a lot of horse races, but I forgot the name of the place now. All I say is Granville, but that's not right. It was Granbury. So we moved in there in a motel on Thursday night or Friday morning and stayed till the next end of the next week. And our leaders are all from the national offices of the Church of the Brethren, our own church. We're doing the two together. Then last year we had it in New Rochelle Park in New Jersey. And this year it's going to be in Columbus, Ohio, and Ohio will be the host to it. And it's on new curriculum, and the writers of curricula are there. And you have classes of no more than 20 or 25 people. And you sleep, and you eat, and you study, and you work all in the same hotel. There's no time wasted running around from place to place. Then we come back and go out and do what we call mini educators in our own areas. Those of us from Ohio had to do, I suppose I've done 6 or 7 of those this last year in the state. And they're just an afternoon and evening up there, but we bring back to them whatever they want out of what we got. But to work with those Canadians, the Church of Brethren, has really been
fascinating experience.
When they asked me to do this work, they were shy of pushing me to do it. And I said, well, I'd take it till they got somebody half my age. Now I'm scared they will.
Well, I'm sure the person half the age wouldn't be able to do the fine job that you're doing.
It gets too demanding. Physically, you can't keep up with it.
That's true. Well, we're just about to the end of the tape, Ms. Hendershot. Is there anything that we've neglected to bring in here that you'd like to say for the future?
I don't know. I believe that living here now and working in the areas, it just seems like it pulls all the rest of it together somehow. One of the greatest joys is to go downtown and be able to speak to people and call them by name and pick up the telephone. They know you before you know them. Without the churches and the schools, we wouldn't have much left, would we? The home is important.
The people of the community are awfully fortunate to have had you, I'm sure.
I'm fortunate that our path brought us to Alliance, too, for I've enjoyed every bit of it here. We moved here, 8 of us, and I'm the oldest, and I'm the only one left. If I weren't busy, I suppose I would become ill.
Well, I hope you have many, many more years for this dedicated service.
It's been pleasant to be here with you this afternoon.
Awfully nice to talk to you.
Thank you.